News and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Hello. We're back. Seems like we were just here, doesn't it?
Except you switched places.
It's Sunday again. Yeah, and it's weird because it's like being on the wrong side of the bed. This is not where I sleep.
Whoa.
I'm not even responding to that.
Why did you switch places?
Because Elizabeth was here first, so she took the other chair. Oh.
It's weird.
But it looks funny.
Elizabeth is usually here first.
Yeah. Good point. Touche.
She stole my chair. She was pretending I wasn't going to be here today, and... And I was
that's right.
Here today.
That's because you thought she wasn't going to be
that's
here.
That's right.
Yeah, that's why she called Mark. Who's
that's right.
There with Bill.
We're all so darn busy, you know, that...
We lost track of each other's schedules.
Stuff flies. Anyway.
This is like the Tonight Show. We had to bump Mark Kent.
he's going to Lowe's. So, Lowe's, you are going to do some business this morning with Mr. Mark Kent. Of Sovereign Minds Radio.
Mark wants brownie points for being here on time.
If you're just tuning in and you think that you flipped the wrong channel and you're listening to a bunch of people yammer on about nothing, you have joined We the People Radio with Elizabeth Woodward, Aaron Ryan, and Bob Martin. And as always, we are streaming and chatting live at wethepeopleradio.us, or give us a call, 605-4567. And if this is your first time tuning in, and I hope that it's not, but if it is, we talk about all things under the umbrella of fiscal responsibility, limited government, and adherence to the Constitution. And if you are breathing and your eyes are opening and you're walking in a straight line, you can't deny the fact that there is a lot of stuff happening underneath that umbrella. And we're going to touch on some great stuff today.
And if you missed, by chance, if you missed the programs on the Humane Society of the United States, you have to go back and listen to them in our archives.
Yeah, because they're getting into big trouble. They're losing their court battles.
I know, which is awesome. And if you think that the Humane Society of the United States, because I just had this conversation yesterday with family, if you think that they're all about saving puppies and kitties, you've missed the boat. If you think they're about stealing your guns, you're getting closer. But if you'd like to know the rest of the story, you should really go back and listen.
And the thing about the Humane Society is it's not tied directly to your local Haven Humane Society.
Necessarily. We'll kind of,
yeah. I mean,
there may be
little fingerling ties that are hard to track,
but
overall,
you know what we discovered?
What?
You know Debbie Bocciacalupi, who lives up in Siskiyou County, who's running for
Congress?
Congressional District 14, used to be 12. It's Jackie Speier. Turns out Jackie Speier is absolutely just lock, stock, and barrel in with the Humane Society of the United States.
No kidding.
And so all the people who are are battling that, they come running in. I think they're going to help Debbie.
Nice.
And they've got a huge network.
Well, and
the people who really care about pets.
And just to shake you in your boots a little bit, if you've ever heard of Charles Manson, well, okay. Just keep
digging. You should listen to the show just to find out what that connection is, because that's just creepy.
So today we're talking forest issues. The U.S. Forest Service is not doing their job.
Forest Service Revitalization is the name of the program, and that's the that's kind of the topic. We've got three guests today. Are you going to call them?
I am. I just wondered if you wanted to, before we get into that, if you wanted to share anything from the conference in Denver last weekend.
I know. It seems like it was 300 years ago. I went to Denver, got to Denver just in time to have a terrible cold and sleep in a hotel room 10 miles away from the Batman killer. So I guess I'll just say the common cold saved my life. And the fact that I didn't like the Batman movie, so that was good. I was double safe.
You were 10 miles away from Aurora the night of that massacre.
Yeah, you know the weird part? A guy that I work with up out of Doris, the guy that bought his elk tag was actually in the theater next door when the bullets came through the wall.
Oh, my God.
So he knew two people there.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I don't know.
What are the odds?
Yeah, it's just strange. I've talked to so many people over the last week who said, oh, my gosh, my brother-in-law was there. So-and-so was going to go to the movie and didn't, you know, just one right after the other. It was a really an
It's just like you didn't board the plane that went down.
Yeah, it was
but you
just a million weird. Well,
and you know, this brings all the kooks out that want you know, massive gun control. But the thing is somebody that's hell bent on killing is going to find a way to do it. I mean, that guy could have locked the doors and set off a bomb, and because clearly he knew how to make bombs. So,
are you going to go
after major bomb control? I mean,
yeah, but see, they had gun control. It was a gun-free zone.
Yeah.
So all the law-abiding people, you know, didn't have guns, so nobody could shoot back. But the Tea Party Patriots Conference actually was quite good. It was a national coordinators conference, and probably about 100 people there, I guess, and really well done. Go to a lot of conferences, and this one was start on time, end on time, just had great information, amazing speakers. We're going to have Carl Smith on and Jesse Lee Peterson. Do we have any... We're trying to arrange.
The work in progress.
Well, the days that are best for him are not the days that are best in this studio. So I'm not sure what we're going to do.
We're trying to pre-record
We're working
them.
On it.
But those guys have put together a movie called Runaway Slave. And that is playing, last I checked, it was playing in Texas. And it was playing in the eastern part of the country, like Atlanta and that sort of thing.
And, you know, Google it and watch the trailer.
The trailer is terrific.
Powerful.
RunawaySlaveMovie.com, I believe, is the actual address. But if you look up Runaway Slave, it was terrific.
Yeah.
We got to see the whole movie. Tea Party Patriots screened the whole movie for us, so that was really neat. Did a lot with different things, you know, fundraising, a whole bunch with the healthcare bill. We spent an entire day. We had all sorts of experts out on the healthcare bill, which was really just things I didn't know. Things I hadn't thought of, and lots of experts that are available to come out and speak to your community, to debate with folks in your area if you're looking for people. So anyway, Tea Party Patriots is a really good resource and something that was a little bit of a sleeper for us out here. We didn't really know what they were up to.
Thank you for calling in to last week's show, by the way, and getting Jenny Beth Martin on for that interview.
Yeah, I thought that she was just walking through the hallway, and I thought, well, hey, here you go. It's kind of funny.
She's the national president? Is that her title?
Co-founder.
Yep. She was one of the people who started it. And so kind of funny, you know, you walk up to somebody, hey, you know, can you jump on this radio program? And like all of us, you know, we do it a lot, so that's not a big deal.
Yeah, yeah.
But I thought about it afterward. I thought, yeah, it was kind of rude.
Yeah, but, you know, she does it a lot, too.
She talked to you for like 15 minutes.
Yeah, she does it a lot, too. So, and you could tell that she does.
Yeah. So yeah.
She's used to it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it really is a valid way to get things done between now and November. And the biggest thing is they're really organized. I'm not going to say that they're like, you know, Uber funded, you know, but but they have put their funding together so that they can help the troops on the ground. And that's the whole point. They're not looking to, you know, reinvent a new party or do anything like that. They're looking to support good conservative politics with grassroots groups. So if you're out there and you're listening and you're like, well, we don't have anybody near us, you should raise your hand.
And there you go.
You should raise your hand and get it done. There are people who will help you.
There you go.
So there you have it.
And so
that's my update.
As usual, the show kind of covers issues that spread far and wide. I mean, we try not to stay too local because anything that we talk about can impact you anywhere you live. And that's why we have listeners from all around the country and also overseas. Keeping up with our good friend in South Korea.
Yeah. And you know, just for fun. We were listening again. Okay, what do I do for fun in the car? I listen.
You listen to left-leaning radio shows.
I do. I listen to Sirius XM Left, channel 127, and I got to tell you, they never disappoint. They never disappoint. You know, you listen, people go, oh, it makes me too mad. Like, no, you've missed the point. See, when you listen to the Fox talk and all that, that makes you mad because you hear about what's really going on, but you listen to their side of it, it just wanders in the darkness. Just fun for everybody. So anyway, we were doing that a little bit yesterday, and you know, I think we're going to be okay. After I do that, I'm like, we're going to be fine in this election.
Yeah, yeah,
we'll be able to be fine.
And
we'll be able to make some changes.
And we have to remember that those viewpoints are the minority. You know, they really are.
Honestly,
they just squeak louder than we do.
Well, you know, all the discussion of it was funny because we flipped back and forth this morning, and all that discussion about people that are millionaires and all that. Well, this other guy called in from Texas. He was an accountant. He goes, you know what? A lot of the people that qualify in this huge tax sweep that they're planning are just regular working people. Mm-hmm. I mean, these aren't, you know, people who own yachts. They're people who have, like, you know, 100,000 bucks or whatever. They earn that between the husband and the wife and this and that.
Yeah, exactly.
But the way the tax code's written and the way this, all these new changes are coming, it's going to hit all those folks. So it's going to hit all your small businesses, and I think we hear that a lot. Mm-hmm. But what we don't hear is this will hear people who have been successful with their work, whatever their work
well,
is.
Well, okay, look at any small family-owned restaurant chain as an example. You know, you'll find those all over the country. They're going to get creamed.
Yeah.
And they're going to get creamed.
And how does that benefit the country?
And how does that benefit anybody?
Well, what is it?
What ends up happening is they go out of business.
Sure, they strip all those. What is it if they strip down all the millionaires and billionaires? It would fund the deficit for like 8 days or something like that.
Or the interest on it.
Yeah, it was just something
silly. Well, you know, and you can take everything everybody has, and our debt is so large and so extensive that it's not going to do it. I mean, that's just a Band-Aid.
No. So
anybody that thinks that taxing the rich more is going to solve any problems at all needs to pull their head out.
Yeah, because we need a different plan.
It's just ridiculous.
It was fun, though. When we got to Walnut Creek yesterday, you know, it's like the land of Prius, you know, the Prii are everywhere. So here we are in a sea of Prii everywhere. And I look at the one in front of us, and it says, it has this thing on the left of the bumper that talks about business type stuff. Then on the right, I'm like, wait a minute, is that a Romney sticker? That's confusing. And all around it are these, you know, we're an alternate fuel vehicle.
Oh, geez.
Like, it's really funny. Just kind of conservative and conflicted there.
Yeah.
But
we
heard on the way in today that
maybe they just want to save on gas.
No, I thought it was just cute.
It is.
It's like anybody, you know, so don't judge. That was what I learned.
Yeah.
We also, on the way in, CARB is planning on, you know, doing their climate exchange. Mm-hmm.
That's the California Air Resources Board.
Or the California Arbitrary Rules.
Not white rice and bread.
Yeah, or their California Arbitrary Rules for Bankruptcy.
There you go. I like that spin better.
I like that better. But the California Air Resources Board is planning on opening their little climate exchange on August 15th for a dry run. There's going to be a huge rally in front of the Capitol, and I would love to tell you what time, and I'll get back to you on that because I forgot to.
Is that August 15th?
It is August 15th. I know that for sure. I just don't know what time. So I'll look it up while we're doing stuff. And anyway, their whole thing is they'd like to see what they're planning on doing with this climate auction, because it really opens. They think it really opens on November 15th. When they do that, the price of gas is going to go up automatically $1 per gallon. Yeah, just like moment of silence.
Yeah,
there.
Let's just stop and let that sink in. Stop and think about that.
So the price of gas is going to go up $1 a gallon, which isn't going to do anything for the, you know, atmosphere. It's not going to do anything for anybody anywhere. But you know what? It will remind people about how much carbon they put out.
What was the date again?
August 15th.
Well, August 15th is when they do their play thing, and then we go protest the heck out of them. And then November 15th, they want to open up the real climate exchange, you know, because
in the big
world, if we change the air over California.
You mean conveniently after the election.
I know. Isn't that funny? I'm sure that's just an accident.
Just a coincidence.
Yeah, they just wanted the 15th because it was like their lucky day.
And then just $1 a gallon, so let that trickle down. The cost of goods being transported to your grocery stores.
Well, how many people? How many people in this state? You know, look how far we have to drive. Look how far some people live. Mm-hmm. Look up here.
Sure.
You know, you truck things from place to place. I don't know. It's just, I think they're smoking it.
Well, make sure you fill up on the 14th.
Exactly. But go down to Sacramento on the 15th, and we'll come back with detail. Okay, so we better take a really swift break, and then do we have our guests with us?
We do.
We are
all
going.
Three
the
of
guys.
Them.
Okay, we're going to come back with Bruce Courtwright. Go ahead, Bob. Yeah, I can see you over there. You've got it all down. Do it.
Larry Alexander, Bruce Courtwright, and Ray Haupt.
Right on. Okay, we'll be right back with you in 2 minutes here at We the People Radio. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM. The home of Free Fire Media.
Hey, little girl, is your daddy home? Did he go and leave you all alone? I got a bad desire.
This is KCNR, the home of Free Fire Media.
I took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charged the people $1.50 just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
Welcome back. You're joining We the People Radio. Jump on the chat room at KCNR 1460 or wethepeopleradio.us. We're streaming and chatting live.
That is hilarious.
It's going to be another great show. Tune in. Don't go anywhere.
Hey, let me, before we move on, let me finish up on the Cap and Trade rally. It's Wednesday, August 15th, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on the steps of the Capitol. So there you have it. And anybody who wants
it. Stock up on gas.
I will post the flyer on our radio page. How's that? It'll be on wethepeopleradio.us. I'm sending it to Robert as we speak.
There you go. Send this out to everybody you know, because people need to get pissed.
They need to hurry up and drive to Sacramento. Well,
if they're not already.
Well, it's a dollar a gallon less.
They just need to. They need to know. All right. No excuses, folks. All the information's there. Oh, and another thing about our webpage. Almost 2 years now. Great shows. Every single show has its individual link. You can send it out far and wide. No excuses not to not to share the knowledge.
There you have it. All right. So now we go back to nice song, by the way, Bob.
Again, well, a good you. Job.
We love that song.
I must give the credit to Joni Mitchell.
Except that it's frighteningly true now. That used to be like a silly song, and now it's not so silly anymore. So I don't know who's first in there.
We would need to adjust it for inflation, but otherwise, yes, it's still true.
That's true. Guys up there, who do we have first? Do we have everybody on a speakerphone? Bruce?
You got us all. We're here. As long as you can hear us.
Right on. Hey,
good morning.
Just for our listeners, why don't you guys give us a little blurb from each of you on a little bit of background?
You want a burp background on us or the Institute?
Yes.
Start with
the whole thing. I'm Bruce Courtwright. I'm the board chair of the National Institute for the Elimination of Catastrophic Wildfire in Fort Jones, California. My background, I'm an organization psychologist by training. I've had about 22 years with the U.S. Forest Service. Retired as assistant to the chief half-time, assistant to the assistant secretary half-time. Currently, I am the chair of six fire safe councils in the Scott Valley area, in addition to the board chair for the Institute. The Institute we set up about 2 years ago because we felt like folks in Washington really did not have a clue as to what was going on out here in the woods, particularly in the national forests around the rural communities. And we felt like we needed to set up an organization that could speak for the people and be a safe place where people could come in and talk about wildfire issues, forest health issues. This is where we are right now. We're sitting in the midst of the Institute, and we're in the process of building a really nice facility. And I'll turn you over to Larry Alexander, who is the current executive director of the Institute, and he can tell you kind of where we are and what's been going on. Larry?
I'm Larry Alexander, executive director for the for Northern California Resource Center and the National Institute for the Elimination of Catastrophic Wildfire. My background is biology, hydrology, and wildland fire. We spend a lot of our time dealing with a lot of the natural resource issues in Northern California, whether it be fire, water, environmental issues. We spend a lot of time working with the public and state agencies and private landowners, helping them weave through all the new and upcoming regulatory processes. But our real focus up here has been wildland fire, public health and safety. And our bottom line message is, you know, let's go back to work in the woods, create jobs, and try to revitalize these communities that have been hit so hard over the last 15 years. And like here in Siskiyou County, 60% of the land base is public lands. And so we need to utilize that resource to some balanced approach. Number one, to create jobs and economy, but before it needs some management out there for the future health of the forest.
And Ray.
Good morning. This is Ray. I am a forester. Most recently, I retired 2.5 years ago from the United States Forest Service after 33 years. My last position was a district ranger on the Klamath National Forest. since retirement, I've been working primarily doing teaching at the College of Siskiyou in Weed, teaching forest ecology, forest hydrology, forest mensuration, and dendrology. I'm a professional forester in the state of California. And regarding the Institute, I was a past collaborator as a federal official with Larry and Bruce. And right now I'm just here to support them.
So you recently attended a workshop in Sacramento. Did all three of you go? Hello?
We missed that question. Please come back one more time.
That's okay. So you recently attended your workshop in Sacramento. Did all three of you attend that?
Yeah, we just completed a workshop in Sacramento. We had about 55 folks, and this was I guess I'd have to call it a summit on the revitalization of the national forests. We were asked by some highly placed retirees of the Forest Service and some others to take a look at the national forests. The feeling is that the way that the national forests were deteriorating, their vulnerability to forest pests and also to fire led to folks to really think that the national forests were not going to survive. We put together a task force to look at that. We had a couple of county commissioners or county supervisors. We had a retired assistant secretary of Department of Interior. We've had some number of retirees on there, ex-forest supervisor. We took a hard look at the national forest and decided that because of what has happened in the past with environmental controls, with the kind of the direction that the Forest Service has moved, they've moved away from their original intent of serving the people in terms of providing commodities and to where local communities could be assured of work and jobs on the national forest and products from the national forest. And we decided what we needed to do was put together some legislation and get Congress to back that would move the Forest Service back onto a neighbor that was both safe to be around but also producing jobs and providing also a quality environment in the forest. This Sacramento meeting was a bringing together of many of the folks who supported us through that time, and they represented many, many groups across the country, both fire and forest health kinds of groups, but also people in the natural resource arena, such as Ray. We came out of there with some recommendations. One was that they felt like our legislation that we had proposed was not strong enough, and we've gone back to the drawing board and done some work with that. They also feel like one of the major issues is the amount of environmental constraints that have been put on the U.S. Forest Service and the national forests, and somehow we need to find a way to break through that. So we are just about a week out of that meeting. We're ready to provide them with feedback from the meeting, and we're ready to go from there.
Now, did Jerry Brown attend this meeting along with the governor from the state of Idaho?
Our political chiefs did not come through for us.
We ended up with
a really good group of folks presenting. We had an ex-chief, Jack Ward Thomas. We had a dean of forestry, Dr. Hal Sawasser, and we had a number of folks from Washington. We even had some from Arizona talking about what they're doing in terms of dealing with catastrophic wildfires.
So the decline of the Forest Service, and in your position paper it states that the U.S. Forest Service used to be the most highly regarded federal agency, and now they have dropped basically to the bottom and have lost all credibility with any partners and specifically in the communities that they're supposed to be serving. What's your take on
Aaron,
that?
Aaron, you're cutting out really bad. I don't know if it's our connection or
I think that might be
close enough to the microphone. But
might be a function of
hear the question.
Okay, I think it might be the speakerphone. How about we need to take a really quick break, thank our advertisers. How about we try to sort that out during the break, and we'll come back with these guys.
Okay.
We are talking about fire, and I don't think that's a newsflash for anybody in the United States who lives by some trees. We'll be back with you on KCNR 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
Hear us streaming 24/7 on KCNR1460.com.
Loving the free and feeling spirit. Hugging a tree when you get near it. Digging the snow and the rain and the bright sunshine.
Welcome back. We are talking with Roy, Larry, and Bruce, and we're talking about Stop the Wildfires in the U.S. Forest Service National Forest, which actually belong to us. And actually, they have a fabulous website, stopthewildfire.org. I encourage everybody to follow along with the conversation by going to that website, stopthewildfire.org. And if I could take a second, I wanted to read a little paragraph from the position paper that was at this conference that these three gentlemen attended in Sacramento. And this kind of sums up the problem with the way that our forests are being managed. Currently, as much through designed neglect as benign neglect, the national forests have been allowed to change from productive forests to fire-prone, insect-infested, and disease-racked lands of declining value to the public. This condition is caused in part by lack of clear management direction for these lands, lack of human and financial resources to protect and manage these lands, and lack of public understanding of the importance of effectively managed forests. So does that sum it up, guys?
Yeah, that's one of the many issues, and it's a good overview. One point we want to stress, just like we did in our conference in Sacramento, is this is not a we're not attacking the Forest Service. We're not a witch hunt for the Forest Service. We're trying to work in the private sector with them to get them in a position so they can do their job better. And so it's a it's trying to work together with them. This whole process has been totally vetted with them, and so that and we try to stay pretty politically neutral and base everything we can, as best we can, on scientific fact. We try not to get sidetracked by rhetoric and keep everything pretty much trying to keep it well grounded in fact as much as we can based on the best available information.
Bob had me muted.
I think, Aaron, the bottom line is that we feel like there are really good people within the U.S. Forest Service today. We feel like the leaders are trying. We think they're hemmed in by environmental regulations. They're also within a Department of Agriculture, which may have different values and different ideas of how they should be managing the forest. But where we stand is that the amount of timber we've got out in the forest is just far exceeds what the land can hold. Where we used to have 100 sticks per acre, we've now got 1,000. Where our canopy, the tops of the trees are closing. There's very little sunlight getting through there. The amount of trees are eating up the water that's available. And when the trees start getting stressed and diseased, the bugs start coming in, eating them up. And when the bugs eat them up, if we can't get them out, they die. And when they die, if we can't get them out, the fires burn. So what we're burning is the precious treasure of the United States. And somehow we've got to open up the forest for some responsible logging and thinning and get that crown canopy lessened so that the forest can become healthy again. And in the same time, provide jobs and sustenance to the local communities.
And, you know, in the Forest Reserve Act of 1891 and then the Organic Act of 1897, the Forest Service's Organic Act specifically states that the purpose for the Forest Service reserves are to ensure a continuous supply of timber for the use and the necessities of the United States citizens. Correct?
Yeah, that's true. Like Bruce said, it seems to be what the problem is. Just annually, the chief comes out and says, okay, we're going to have X million board feet of cut to put out this year. And they come up with these goals and documents that lay out what can and should be done, but it usually ends up getting locked up with environmental challenges. And it's kind of like gridlock. And so, as an example, I mean, they can say, the cut's going to be a nice large amount for this year, but they can't, practically speaking, get it out on the ground because of all the challenges and bureaucratic processes. And, it's a good goal and maybe the right goal, but in practicality, in a lot of cases, it's not doable.
And
the current environment.
And in your position paper, you identify all of the litigation that the Forest Service is constantly up against as an actual industry.
Well, there is a lot of litigation that has gone on. There also is environmental acts that are really getting in our way. And I guess I'd give you an example. When the spotted owl controversy started back in the mid-50s, there was a small town called Happy Camp, which is on the Klamath River, which is on the Klamath National Forest. And before the owl issue started, they were probably having the largest timber cut of any district in this area, and maybe the largest in California. And when the owl legislation passed, half of their area that they could cut was off limits because it was set aside for the owl. And what happened was they had a number of sawmills there. They've all gone out of business. The logging operators have gone out of business. The town is drying up. Mm-hmm. The crime rate is high. And now what has happened, the environmental, there is going to be more law brought in where they want more set aside for the owls, since that didn't work the first time. And and it's basically going to take the rest of their district. So what we've got is a situation where for trying to manage for one critter, we have ruined the economy of an entire area, and the bottom line is there are no more owls than there were 20 years ago in that area. And to boot, there's another owl which has moved in, which is the barred owl, which kind of likes that kind of a territory, and it's a little more aggressive, and it's pushing out the owls that are there. So what we've got is an environmental legislation that is saying, well, it didn't work the first time,
let's do it
so
again.
We're going to try taking more land the second time and make it work this time. And we are very concerned about the future of what's going to happen in the Northwest if that's allowed to run its course. And we think something needs to be done, and it's going to have to be done through the Congress.
And so at the end of the day, I know you said you guys are not looking to advance any of the rhetoric, but honestly, there's no legitimate argument that can be made on the other side. I mean, when you have all these fires, you've decimated the economy, you've decimated all sorts of things, and now they're truly ruining the environment they want to save because it's going up like a bomb all over the country.
Aaron, maybe I can address that a little bit. One of the things that the American public doesn't seem to understand, there's good reason for that. I mean, this is a highly technical issue. When you have a forest that has been managed quite intensively for 100 years, and then you stop management and you add fire suppression to it, like what was done in the West, it predisposes it to a certain number of catastrophic environmental swings. And one of those is that a lot of our forests have been changed over to faster growing, younger timber. And what that does is, without going into great detail in a forestry lesson here, you have basal areas that can be carried on an acre for a period of time much above what that acre is possible of growing. In other words, an acre can only grow so much wood based on its physical limitations of both weather, solar radiation, and nutrient. Now, when a tree grows, starts off as a seedling, and it grows to, most of our mixed conifer species around here grow to about an age of somewhere around 80 years, 60 to 80 years, depending on the species. And then they start to slow down. They hit their adult lifehood, like we do. There's a lot of genetics locked in that growth spurt, as we were as youth, the same. But once it hits that period, it can no longer carry those basal areas. So stopping management in a way of thinning is not the answer, because what it does is it predisposes very large landscapes to catastrophic collapse, makes them ripe for these fires that we're seeing across the West. Why should we be concerned about that? We should be concerned about that because walking away is not natural. Though that's politically what you'll always hear, that's nature's course. Well, we have a forest that's not natural. And we as the American public, I believe, need to come to grips with that. As such, we can manage it within the natural range of variability to match what nature had put there. If we don't do that, we get fires. And I was asked by someone I respect recently about what is a catastrophic fire. Well, to me, a catastrophic fire is one that is outside its natural range of variability. That is, when you have greater than, in the Klamath Mountains and the Shasta Trinity, when you have a fire that has a severity greater than 20% of the area in total consumption of the biomass during that event, that's outside the natural range of variability. Mm. We have fires now that are pushing 50, 60% high severity. That is not natural. What that does is, from an ecological perspective, it switches our watersheds from what's called secondary succession, where all the nutrients are intact, all the soil is intact, the vegetation gets burned a little bit, But everything's there to recolonize that site and carry forward in the future in a pretty fast recovery. That's, if fire were in its natural range, that's what fire does. If selective thinnings and selective cutting mimic nature, that's what that type of logging would do. Now, what we have right now is something called primary succession, and that's similar to volcanic eruption on these sites, where you completely denuded the entire vegetation from the site. You've taken all of the flora and fauna out of the soil, so you're rebuilding the entire food web and everything else from the bottom up. That takes centuries. That's not a 20 to 50-year process, as the secondary succession would be.
Well, I think your initial thing was correct, that people really don't understand. But they do understand that, I mean, anybody who's been around for any length of time, I mean, I'm 50, so I'm kind of, you know, in the middle of the deal. But when we were kids, there weren't fires that burned for ever. I mean, it just didn't happen. That things have obviously changed. Something has obviously changed.
Well, and think about if you've lived anywhere in a timber community. I remember as a kid always seeing logging trucks driving through town loaded with timber. You never see that anymore. I mean, that used to be a staple of the community.
Yeah, not much. And now we see what's going on with our schools. Okay, really swift break. We'll be right back with the guys. We are talking about the Forest Service and fires and timber and how we manage things. And we will be right back with you here at We the People Radio. We hope you'll pop on the webpage and do a little reading. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM.
You and I travel to the beat of a different drum. How can you tell by the way I run?
Hear us streaming 24-7 on KCNR1460.com.
You say you've got to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything. You've got to be your own man, not a puppet on a string. Never compromise what's right and uphold your family name. You've got to stand for something. Are you for anything?
We're back. We're just about to wrap up our first hour. Yeah.
Stand for something.
Like, I love that.
Yeah, but
I
is
love
it like
that.
Fall for anything, like fall trees? Is that what we're talking about?
Was that your point?
Fall leaves.
Okay, so in 1960, the Forest Service passed the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act, which reaffirms, it's actually Congress reaffirmed, that the Forest Service, the public lands would be used for outdoor recreation, range, timber, watershed, wildlife, and fish purposes. Timber was in there.
Guess they forgot that part.
Yeah.
So, guys, we've got about 5 minutes before the news break. What would you, if you were going to condense this down and really encourage the public to focus in on this, what's the most salient point you would give them?
They're discussing
I think,
it.
Are you guys
having your own meeting? You can't have your own meeting.
A couple of things. We're not anti-fire. we understand fire's role ecologically in the system within its natural range of variability. What we're against is the catastrophic fire that is a soil sterilizing event, one that burns so hot that the watershed has a very, very long recovery. And in some cases, you can end up with a complete conversion of vegetation to a scrub where you're not going to see tree vegetation for quite some time. We never would in our lifetimes. That affects the entire balance of the ecosystem, including the water delivery for us who depend on water. It does not allow the agency to complete its mission under the sustained flow perspective. Small fires, the agency can recover from, but when you have, several hundred square miles, as we're seeing in Colorado and New Mexico, taken out of production, there's no way that the Forest Service could meet its mission and sustain flow of any type of products for the American public. And let's face it, we're talking about timber here, but no other amenity will be allowed to be delivered to the American public the way they had enjoyed that land prior to those types of events either. A couple things that, we also discussed is things have changed. Due to lack of management, we had things, if you step back maybe 20 years ago when there was some active management in the forest, the equipment was readily available to fight these fires and to put them out. And in many cases, the fire was out by the time we got there because the equipment was in the woods. Now when it's a 3-hour response from a fire department or something on a road that's never been maintained in the last 10, 15 years, it's difficult under initial attack to get there before a fire gets established. And once a fire is established, it's very difficult to control.
And as they close roads,
so this whole thing with let's just watch nature grow and let's watch the fires burn and everything will be happy, it just isn't responsible in our perspective.
And as they close roads,
I think the bottom line is that we want people to know is that we've got to get back into the forest. We've got to open up the forest for some responsible thinning and cutting. And if we don't do that, with the climate getting hotter, the weather itself getting far more uncontrollable, we're going to find ourselves with a buildup each year, probably worse than we've got this year. And we're going to end up with no national forests out there, with degradation to our water, and it's going to be a really bad situation unless we can do something about it. And we need folks to talk to their congressmen and explain that we really need help, particularly the small communities in the West.
Guys, we're going to come back. We have another hour with these guys. Bob, you're going to have to mute because they can't hear me. We've got a news break here for 5 minutes. You've got 5 minutes to catch up on your coffee, and we'll be right back with you here at We the People Radio. You're listening to KCNR, 1460 AM. We're back. Hour two of We the People Radio. If you are just tuning in, came back from church or getting ready to go or finally woke up, grab a cup of coffee, jump on the chat room at wethepeopleradio.us. Always a fun place to be. We're streaming live also. We're at KCNR 1460, the home of Free Fire Media. You're joining Elizabeth Woodward, Ryan Aaron, yeah. And Bob Martin.
It all depends on if I'm in gym class or not.
Hey, that's kind of cool.
What?
Your name, it's interchangeable. Her name is interchangeable.
Just figured that out.
Woodward Elizabeth, that doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. No. Martin Bob, now that does, kind of, in an odd way.
It could. A little odd, but it could.
He could be Martin Roberts. That'd work.
There you go.
All right, so we are...
Brian Aaron.
I know, we did that with gym class already.
Yes.
We were already in gym class.
Well, it depends on what you want to get out of.
Like, going to make us go check our lockers now.
It worked for you because you have two first names.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. So we are talking to Bruce Courtwright, Larry Alexander, and Ray Haupt up there in Siskiyou County. They are speaking from the National Institute for the Elimination of Catastrophic Wildfire. And website is stopwildfire.org. And I'll just read you the first sentence, two sentences, sorry. America's 193 million acre national forest system is in serious decline. The United States Forest Service was created to be the congressional designated manager of the forest and to be the leader of professional forestry in the United States. And we all know how that's turning out. So I won't read further.
Hey, so I've got a question for you guys. Can you hear me better?
I hear you just fine.
Great, great. We had a speaker at our local Tea Party meeting not too long ago who also worked within the Forest Service, retired, wrote a book about how affirmative action within the U.S. Forest Service has not only destroyed the morale of that agency, but has also hindered that agency's ability to effectively manage the forests. Do you guys have a take on that?
Yeah, I think I do. I'm an ex-personnel officer back in my old days.
Now, I did not know that. How apropos.
Right. So I guess my response to that is that, you know, affirmative action was a major thing that the Forest Service had to do legally. And they now within the department is very, very concerned about that. And I think what has happened is that they are working hard on affirmative action. They are selecting candidates based on affirmative action. I think the problem is not affirmative action itself. I think they're selecting good people, but the people don't have the experience. They don't have the experience, the knowledge that it takes to get the job done, and the organization's training capability, of which I was a training officer also, and based on trying to cut back in funds, they've cut back on the training for new leaders, and new leaders are now coming out with very little experience, very little training, and they're left on their own, and they're stumbling. They're stumbling both with their own staffs, but more importantly, when we're in a collaborative society, and if we're going to manage a piece of land collaboratively, the leader has to have expertise in dealing with local governments, tribes, local groups, and is going to have to be adept at working in that collaborative environment. A lot of the new folks that are being brought on board have not got the experience or the training to do that, and they're stumbling. And the people in the local collaboratives are losing faith. So now, the outfit has got to figure a way, if they're going to continue to bring people in with less than their traditional experience, they're going to have to build up a program to give them that training and experience, and we have offered to help them do that.
One of the things that I wasn't really going to address this, but I think I will. There are two key things that stand out in my mind more than any. One is that there's a cultural change within the agency and within government. When I started my career 30 years ago, those who worked for the agency had a passion for what they were doing, and they wouldn't do anything else. Didn't matter how much it paid. People like me dedicated their lives to the continuing of management of resources and the continual knowledge. It didn't stop with college. What we did was not a process. That changed dramatically in the government about the end of the 1980s, where at the time some of the administrations were touting the fact that any manager could manage anything. I've never believed that. It's difficult to make decisions, environmental legal decisions, if you don't know the context of your decision. I don't know how you could possibly do that without some technical background in resource management. The other aspect of that is I heard a well-respected personnel officer say one time that the issue is not so much the workforce we have. It's the fact that the workforce is designed by the Office of Personnel Management, and OPM dictates who's qualified for a particular position. And in his quote, he said, "You have to give them. You have to give OPM credit. They have greatly. They've spent a lot of time, a lot of resources, and designed the perfect workforce for the 1950s. And that is the case. Forestry has changed a great. Well, wasn't even really what the science it is today in the 1960s. Yet the forester classification that the U.S. Forest Service uses has not been reviewed by OPM since 1965. So there are those inherent things in government that also contribute to what would consider is all the effect of affirmative action.
Well, you know, if you think about it, true forest management, and just a little qualifier, my husband is also a registered professional licensed forester in the state of California. So true healthy forest management practices tend to be very physical. It's not easy work. And I have to wonder if the U.S. Forest Service has, if it's heavily weighed in personnel that are not capable of that physical strenuous work, if that's why they've changed the definitions and the methods of professional forest management to accommodate the inability of those to do the physical work.
No, I don't think that's the case.
Okay.
I think the people we're getting now that we're bringing in, particularly the young folks, males and females, are just as well qualified as each other. And Ray is making signs that the reality is they spend an awful lot of time on the internet, and not the internet, but the computer, trying to work out. That's how they communicate. So
it's been a great, I can tell you, the 20 years ago, the bulk of a forester's time was spent in the forest, learning about the forest, interpreting the forest, and applying the management techniques that they learned in college. I would doubt that any forester today, a journeyman forester in the agency working at the field level, will tell you that they spend more than 20% of their time in the field, as the bulk of their time is spent behind a desk trying to meet the compliance of a plethora of laws, often with conflicting direction, that dictate how the forest should be managed.
All right. We better take a really quick break because my next question is going to take too long to answer. I want to know, when we come back, we'd really like to know where you guys see this going. Are they interested in fixing it? Are they interested in input? Or is this going to be something where you're just going to have to knock on the door harder and harder and harder and maybe get the public behind you on it? So anyway, you're listening to We the People Radio. We hope you guys will tune in with us online. We're here at KCNR 1460 AM.
Join the conversation in our chat room, KCNR1460.com.
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you fire.
We're back. So, gentlemen. Oh, and I have to segue here in just a little brief detour. If you don't listen closely to the music of the shows that we have each week, you really need to.
You've missed Bob's genius.
Bob Martin does a fantastic job of applying every song directly to the topic that we're covering.
How many fire songs are there, Bob?
I have not reached that total yet.
Did you have options,
still
choices?
Still discovering them. Yeah, there were some that didn't make the show today.
There's more fire songs than we had fire song slots?
That's right.
That is outstanding.
And it's kind of weird because a lot of the music is from like the 60s, 70s.
Yeah, fire was big back
then. Nothing very current.
We're not really sure
hey,
why.
Hey, Bob, I like your shirt.
Fire's too politically incorrect a topic nowadays, I guess.
Oh, that must be it. We don't do PC here.
Fire went out of vogue. It's funny. Just as the fires were starting, it became not popular in music. So we have Comrade Ann on the phone, eh?
We will in just a moment, like now. Ann?
Like right now.
Yeah.
Ann, you're on the front page of the newspaper.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that great?
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom feeders are out in full force.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, all the bloggers in their mother's basement are busy hammering you.
See,
yeah.
If somebody came and ripped out all of their fruit trees, I'd like to hear their side of the story then.
Yeah, my question is, I wonder if they change their underwear when they're sitting in front of their computers day in and day out.
Probably not. probably
hey,
not because they called you a moron, so we're going to throw them under the bus. Boom.
Yeah.
Okay, so go on.
Hey, here's my question, or Fred's question.
Fire away.
Is multiple use pretty much dead and gone as far as a policy in the Forest Service because of it certainly seems that way because of the environmental extremism that seems to have taken over the Forest Service?
I don't know.
And also, you know, everything they want to shut down seems like it could be handled in a responsible way, and we could all adhere to their environmental concerns. But it just seems like they just want to blatantly shut everything down instead of talking about it and working together on it.
And can the guys up there in Siskiyou County, can you hear us?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Did you catch that question there?
So one of the things we were discussing over the break was that, I listened to Jack Ward Thomas speak one time, and he has a paper called The Process Predicament.
I am.
If you haven't read that, it's well worth your read, and it's you can find it easily on the Internet. He described the agency, and this was 10 years ago, described the agency as a stallion that was so closely tethered to the ground by environmental regulation and litigation that there was no way possible for it to move. And so part of what we're working on is what Jack recently describes as the Gordian knot and cleaving that knot. In other words, freeing it so that it can perform its mission.
So what do you think about the idea of multiple use, Ray?
We think is probably some of the more salient things here is, first off, you know, the discussion you were having before I started to talk was, in understanding government, you have to understand that I guess government is a mere reflection of society, especially in land management. And whatever's pounding on an agency at the time seems to be where it goes. It's kind of like shoving water around or shoving putty around. And since about the end of the 1980s, the upper hand in the public discussion has been on the environmental side of things. Prior to that, it was on the industry side of things. What we would hope to see is some balance. And that balance would be centered around a rebuilding of public support, because quite frankly the agency will not change what is currently going on until the public supports it again in its mission. And right now my summary is the agency is floundering so poorly, largely due to the fact that they can't come up with something that the public supports. And until the public gets behind the Forest Service, as it has in the last 15, 20 years with its money and support for environmental organizations, the situation will not change.
And two things occur to me. One is there is some move to replace the Forest Service with groups, give it to the states, give it to the counties, break up the forests and have different people manage different parts. And our feeling is that, you know, 80 years went into building the Forest Service the way it was 20, 25 years ago. And what they built was a Cadillac. And the question, right now, the Cadillac has got a bad motor. What we need to do is a little engine tune-up and not throw the Cadillac away, because I think with a little bit of work, that Cadillac could work for us again just as good as it did 20 years ago. And if we try to break that up and let other folks manage the national forests, I don't think that they've got the size, the depth, or the breadth to do that. And I think we're going to flounder. So we've got to save that Cadillac and get it back on the road.
Do you think that there is any appetite for multiple use, as our caller asked? Do you think that they would, that there is any interest in going back to that again?
Interest in going back to where? Interest in going back to balance? Yes, a great deal of that. Interest in going back to the timber wars of the 1980s? I really doubt it. Historically, if you look at that, we had a different lobby that was controlling the actions of the agency, largely the timber industry, but for very good reason. A couple of things that were occurring during that era that the Forest Service is painted for being evil for were that the nation was terribly concerned that until all the old growth was cut, all of the mills couldn't be retooled to properly manage the younger timber that was coming online at the time. If you also recall, at the time, to those listeners that weren't old enough to have lived it, at that particular point in time, we had just come out of an administration that left the incoming Reagan administration with a negative GDP growth. Also a unemployment rate that was nearly twice what it is today. So the way the agency responded through the political power in place was to go into something called departure. In other words, cut higher than what you were growing. That put a bad taste in the American public. It left us with what was called the Timber Wars of the 80s. And in that case as well, it didn't meet the sustained yield mission of the agency either, because it left a hole in that sustained flow. So is there a simple answer to the question, is there a desire to go back? There's a desire to go to responsible management, yes. Believe me, there's no taste in hardly anybody's mouth that works in the agencies, because I'm still in contact with a lot of them, to continue this gridlock and litigation.
And I think one of the challenges is going to be looking at the environmental side. You know, we want good environmental management, but what our environmental scientists who are proposing legislation need to grasp is that we can't manage for one species. And at our meeting in Sacramento, Dr. Hal Sawasser brought out that instead of trying to manage for one critter and while allowing the other critters to suffer, what we need to do is build and manage for healthy ecosystems so that all the critters can thrive. And as long as we single out one little critter and try to build all of our systems around that, we're going to still end up in the same place we are now. We've got to come at it from a different viewpoint.
Yeah, that different viewpoint is very simple. It's the difference between ecology on 1 acre or ecology at a landscape scale. And the endangered species does not address landscape ecology. It addresses an acre-by-acre approach for the habitat of an endangered species. No watershed, no landscape functions that way because there's disturbance within those landscapes naturally. And until we look at habitat on a landscape scale, we'll never recover watersheds, we'll never recover species, and we'll continue to place our valued treasures, the public land, at risk.
So after your conference 2 weeks ago, after conference 2 weeks ago, what did you guys think came out of that in Sacramento? You had quite a few people there. Might tell people a little more about that.
Well, we had about 55 people there, And I think what came out of the conference was about six or seven things. One, the realization that the confidence in the U.S. Forest Service to come out of this on its own is not there. They see that there needs to be a major sea change from the national forests to manage to the Forest Service in managing the national forests. There also was a strong feeling that there needs to be legislation that somehow breaks this Gordian knot that Ray was just talking about, and it's got to be something that is really significant, and it's going to have to be powerful enough to make that happen. They also saw the need for real public relations from the Forest Service, talking about the good things that are happening. All we're hearing are the bad things, and we need to start hearing some of the good work that they're doing on the ground, and they are doing good work. And an example of that is we're going to be meeting with a forest supervisor on Wednesday to kick off a collaborative restoration area of about 500,000 acres. And it's going to be managed, you know, with a board. We're going to be trying to do some of the same things that we're talking about in the legislation. I think what also came out of the meeting is that the need for spreading the word that we're talking about right now, that something has to happen in the revitalization of the national forests or we're going to lose them. And we've got to spread that in the schools. We've got to spread that over the radio, in the papers. And our strategy is we're going to meet with every group that will tolerate us and talk about what we're doing and try to get them interested in supporting us. We do have some interest from some Congress folks now at this point. One area that came out of the conference was high concern over the way that fires are being managed nationally, which some feel are exacerbating the situation we've got with the catastrophic wildfire. And our institute is sponsoring a research fellow working with Congressman Steve Pierce in New Mexico and with the Forest Service, and they're going to take a look at some of the issues that surround the catastrophic fires for the past 10 years or so and try to come out with some ideas of how we can better manage our whole fire system that we've got to deal with in the United States. And we're looking at our institute with several other institutes sponsoring a national summit on fire sometime after the election.
Well,
that probably covers it.
Well, when you say that, you know, you made mention of the fact that how the fires are being handled, what does that mean for I'm sorry, we're supposed to take a break. Okay, when we come back, sorry, Bob. I see Bob over there flashing through his flashcards.
No worries.
So he can show me the other flashcard that says, for Lord's sake, pay attention. he needs one of those flashcards. When we come back, though, could you tell us how the fires are being managed and how you would like that to be changed or what you think would be more successful if they made some changes? Because I think a lot of people know it's bad. They just don't know enough about fire to know what should be different. So we will talk about that when we come back after we hear a couple of more fire tunes and some nice advertisers who are helping our show. So you're here at KCNR 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
The hotline is open on KCNR 1460 530-605-4567.
Maybe I'll be there to shake your hand. Maybe I'll be there to share the land that they'll be giving away when we all live together. Talking about together.
In utopia.
Bob, you hippie.
Kumbaya, baby.
in the new utopia, soon to be a dystopia.
Oh, my God.
Don't you think?
All right.
I think we're already there.
Bob, I got to tell you.
In the dystopia.
I got to love your shirt.
Yeah.
I love your shirt. It reminds me of the Beach Boys.
Oh, that gives me the creeps after our HSUS show. I don't like the Beach Boys anymore. I heard them.
Yeah.
And they gave me the,
oh, yeah.
Gave me the heebie-jeebies.
Oh, that's true. Never mind. Forget I
yeah,
said that.
Yeah, you said that.
Yeah, they were nasty.
Yeah.
Well, okay. In fairness,
You had the shirt before you knew
I
that?
I think they... no, this has nothing to do with the shirt. The Big Dog Aloha shirt, by the way. Shameless plug there. I think the Beach Boys, didn't they play for Ronald Reagan and...
they hung out with Charles...
I mean, they...
They hung out with Charles Manson.
I'm saying, many people in the 60s, they came around to conservatism in their later years.
They were part of the Process Church. They were Satan worshipers.
And
game over twice.
Orgy participants.
There was a lot of bad stuff. Hey, if you haven't heard that show on the Humane Society we did, you should really go back and listen. It was really quite stunning. Okay, so back to fire, which sounds like a much cleaner topic.
Okay.
What? You're still trying to save the Beach Boys?
Our pal Warren Duffy managed them at one time.
We got to ask him about that.
Yeah.
Let's call Warren.
Let's get Warren on the show. We actually are. I think Warren's on next week, as a matter of fact.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. As a matter of fact.
Well, how serendipitous.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'll do my homework on the Beach Boys. Okay. So, fellas in fire country up there. Okay, talk to us about how the fires are being managed and how the fires should be managed. Because you hear all the time about how they drop like these, these explosive like bombs on the top of the fire to try to burn it out. And that's big controversy.
Well, and what about the flame retardants?
Yeah, what about that?
So how are they doing it, and how should they do it?
They all passed it.
In layman's terms.
We spent time during the break talking about what we thought we'd talk about, and then you threw me a different question.
Oh, I am so sorry. Why don't you talk about what you're talking about, and just come back to us whenever you're ready. We don't care.
We're nothing if not unpredictable.
We have no needs.
Yeah.
The agency is struggling with a number of things, one being something called cost containment. And while the public's on most of the fire agencies' back to put these fires out at all costs, Congress is on their back saying, don't spend any money doing it. And so they have highly charged auditors on their back during the management of most of these fires, questioning every retardant drop, every use of an aircraft, every use of this or expenditure here or there. Need to understand that because it's not as simple as just grabbing a tool and going out and doing the work. A couple things that in response to that, it's been happening due to lack of vegetation management on the National Forest. Some have seen an opportunity maybe to manage part of the vegetation through natural fire events rather than put them out immediately. I think that's part of what you wanted to talk about. Let's talk about that for a minute. While that may have been possible from a carte blanche perspective 100 years ago, it's not possible today for a number of reasons. One, there's a lot of wildland urban interface in the way. People don't tolerate smoke the way they, there weren't as many people around 100 years ago. And our forest was in a much different condition 100 years ago. And the agency has struggled with a policy. It was let burn. It was prescribed natural fire. It was management response to fire. And every time the agencies get hit with the latest political issue associated with not putting a fire out directly, they change the name of that response. So let's talk a little bit about that. In order to be successful at that, you have to have a number of things in place. Number one, you have to have seasoned decision makers who thoroughly understand the technical complexities of fire itself, fire behavior, and the fuels at which the fire is occurring. On top of that, a prescribed fire program that's active on the landscape and a vegetation program that's active on the landscape, which neither of which are current today, allows a mosaic of fuels to build on the landscape that stops these catastrophic fires from expanding to hundreds of square miles. Without that present, I question the effectiveness of a managed fire at this point in time, unless it's late in the season, and typically in places where you're limited anyway, like wilderness. But certainly not in what we would consider the danger zone or the fire zone that threatens communities. One of the there's a couple of things. We would prefer initial attack at this point on every fire. And though there are decisions that go into that, whether or not it's safe to do direct attack, indirect attack, those kinds of things, those are discussions for the fire teams and decision makers, as well as cost. But one thing that the public doesn't often, they're not often confronted with is there are a limited number of firefighting forces that can actually be deployed on any given day. When you have multiple events like we did here in Northern California 4 years ago now, there just weren't enough resources to put all fires out. And what often occurs is remote places like Happy Camp and the near neck of the woods, Hay Fork, and places like that, way out in the sticks, are the last to receive a resource. And in initial attack, if you're unsuccessful in your first shift, chances that you're going to catch that fire in the next shift are very small. So those fires get established and they get very big. And they have very large results. So even with the greatest desire to put every fire out, it's not going to happen. So what's the answer to that? A managed forest. A managed forest, both with prescribed fire as well as with vegetation management like logging, thinning, that sort of thing, allows the landscape to be in a more resilient situation to where it's broken up in these pieces where you can actually catch the fire later on. What else do you think, guys? What did I miss?
I think those are good points. Here last year we had an example with a local forest where the forest supervisor had a lightning strike out in a remote area. Forest supervisor brought together the community and some fire experts, and we sat in a room to decide is this a place that we could let burn and get some resource benefit or not? And it was a collective decision. And I know the forest supervisor was willing to, if the group said, no, let's go put it out, that's what would have happened. But it became a day-to-day thing, and it was let burn and managed with a crew on the ground. And it did some good up to a point. And when that point hit, the decision was made is to put it out, and they did. And so there are, like we said earlier, all the public hears about the Forest Service is all the bad things, you know, the headlines. But there are a lot of good things on different forests that are happening day to day. And the Forest Service doesn't get credit for the good things they're doing. Even outside of forestry and fire, I mean, community involvement, there's a whole array of things that the Forest Service is benefiting the community, but they just the public doesn't hear about that.
And I guess coming back to what Ray said about the leaders having good experience in fire, good knowledge about fire, that is critical, because what the agency has been pushing for, most fires, large fires, are commanded by an incident commander. And in the past, they tend to go on their own with not a whole lot of contact with the forest supervisor or even a ranger, the leader. And there's been a push to have the leaders and the incident commanders really working more in concert. But the only way that's going to work is if the forest leader is either a ranger or a forest supervisor has some fire knowledge and experience so they can do a good quality job of managing a fire. And there's going to have to be a far better job of getting these folks up to speed on the leadership side. The fire leaders, the incident commanders, are well trained and do a fine job. They've got a fine training program that takes care of them, but not for the other folks.
Yeah, and I think just to reinforce a the thing that Ray mentioned, kind of a bottom line message to the public, is right now, because of the conditions of the forest for the most part, the agency has very few options. And one of the answers to that in the perfect world is, like Ray said, through vegetation management, which have numerous tools to get there, it puts the forest in a position to be more resilient on its own, buys time, and provides the agency with a bigger array of options in how to treat something. Because right now it's kind of in a position of a no-win situation. It's like no matter what they do, it's really not going to be 100% effective unless we really treat the cause. Right now we're treating the symptoms, so we need to get back on the ground and treat the cause.
I'd like to address, I don't know if we have time right now, but I'd like to address what you asked me prior to answering what I wanted to answer.
Okay, you have a free 2-minute prep time. How's that? Does that work for you? We have to take one more quick break. We'll come back and you can tell us whatever you want till the top of the hour. You can even blow my question off completely. You're listening to We the People Radio here at KCNR 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
I'm riding in your car. You turn on the radio. You're pulling me close. I just say no. I say I don't like it, but you know I'm a liar. 'Cause when we kiss, ooh, fire.
This is KCNR, the home of Free Fire Media.
Green door, what's that secret you're keeping?
There's an old piano and they play it hot behind the green door. Don't know what they're doing, but they laugh a lot behind the green door. Wish they'd let me in so I could find out what's behind the green door.
Well, we could take a wild guess.
Hey, you can find them at XM Channel 127 left.
There you go. Hey, so guys, I want to know, with the forest not being managed and actually, as you mentioned earlier, the Forest Service personnel spends the majority of their time behind a desk. Does that make the Forest Service land really attractive to, you know, people growing suspicious plants out there?
Hello.
You get what I mean?
Elizabeth wants to know if
does
they're all growing
the
pot in the woods.
Does it make the job attractive? If you're a lawyer, I suppose.
So some of the pot growers aren't
there. I want to go back and address a couple of things, if I could, that you posed. One being bombs, firefighting tactics,
yeah,
and those sorts of things.
Did he say bombs?
Having been a student of 40 years of fire, and a great deal of experience both with prescribed fire and burn fire, and being on fire teams as well. Personally, I've been able to, use fire effectively most of my career, and occasionally got burnt. Because fire is not predictable. By its very nature, fire does what fire does, and it can't be defined. So there are certain things that, within the normal response, fire does this, but it's the anomalies that are gotchas all the time. So let's talk about these fire bombs you were talking about a little bit ago. And let's get right to the heart of the matter, what you'll hear on every environmentalist webpage. It's called burnout. And a great deal of controversy associated with that. Truthfully, if you're educated in fuels management, there shouldn't be any controversy. Because there are three things that you can eliminate to put a fire out. One is oxygen, which you have no control over. The other is the ignition source itself, which you already have. And the other is the fuel. And I can guarantee you that any prudent line officer confronted with the decision of will I burn out or not, in the face of taking a stand against a fire that separates the fire from the community, they will order the burnout. It is a measure of last resort in that case, but it's normally done on the ground and supported aerially with what you call bombs. It's not all that nefarious. It's actually a ping pong ball that has a chemical in it, and it is injected with another chemical that makes it react similar to napalm. And it hits the ground, and it doesn't explode. It just consumes the ping pong ball and the fuel that's in it and starts a small spot fire. That's used a lot of times from the air by itself as well to encourage a fire to go in a certain direction. It's also used at times during the management of a fire, during the lull periods of a fire when it's not making terrific advances, to lessen the impact of where the fire is going to go anyway. I know a lot of people have picked up a flag against this technique, but I can tell you without it, you might as well pull your, sit on your deck, pour yourself a pina colada, and wait for the fire to consume you. That's as simple and basic and honest as I can be with, with that particular technique. consultation agreement regarding retardant you ask about. Currently, the Forest Service, prior to every fire season, has to go through a process under the Endangered Species Act to somehow determine before fire season starts what the impact on endangered species will be during initial attack and extended attack of fire response. As part of that, they are forced into consultation agreements with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service for the protection of endangered species. Currently, there is a very restrictive agreement placed on the use of retardant in the proximity with streams and watersheds, and it's, I believe, I'm not an expert right now because I'm not no longer working, but I believe it's 300 feet from any waterway. That's tough to do with an aircraft moving a couple hundred miles an hour.
Yeah, no kidding.
Being very cautious not to auger into the landscape before they drop their load and being able to pull out. That's a lot to ask of a pilot. It's a life and death decision whether or not to use retardant. And with those restrictions placed on top of everything, I'm sure the agency is gravitating toward the most conservative use, being on ridgetops where there's no further encumbrances to the life of the pilot. As far as predicting fire itself and knowing where a fire is going, what I'm concerned about, and then we talked about the office jockey position, which is what I call it, sitting behind the computer and that kind of thing. All kinds of great predictive tools are done now for where a fire is going to go, when it's going to get there, and everything else. They can't be followed carte blanche. My use of models in the past, they've largely over-predicted and under-predicted certain other aspects. So without the coupling of very personal, detailed information about the fire you're managing, they're a guide. They're just another piece of the discussion. So to follow them carte blanche, I think, is a real mistake. But that's, I think some might gravitate toward that because not having the personal experience with fuels on the ground and fire behavior, that's where you have to go to make a decision, and that's unfortunate.
So
you guys have to add.
You guys wind up.
I guess the bottom line for me is that thinking about your listeners, they need to be looking at educating themselves about fire, and if they're anywhere near a national forest or a piece of land that's forested, a good place would be their fire safe council. go to a local Fire Safe Council meeting and ask some of your questions. And if they don't have the answers, they'll get them for you. The other would be to utilize our website, which is stopwildfire.com.
.org.
And we put the latest information we've got on there on fire, wildfires, forest regeneration, and it would be a good place to get some quick education into what's going on. And I guess the last thing would be to encourage folks to get involved. Listen to what's going on. Don't just listen to the person who wants to really create a lot of dust. Find out what really the bottom line is and what is happening out there on the national forest and on your local forest.
Yeah, make sure you listen to We the People Radio.
And talk about it.
Yeah, and I agree. I just want to reinforce the self-education. Be aware. Don't follow the rhetoric. And it's okay to you know, attack an organization or whatever, but if you're going to do that, go in with well-founded facts. Don't just go in with a bunch of talking points that came out of the headlines or a bunch of rhetoric. You know,
okay,
don't waste time chasing rabbit trails.
We're going to call
really
you.
Really educate yourself. Find out what's going on, because there's a lot of great information.
Bye, guys. We'll see you next time. Thanks for coming on. See y'all next week on We the People Radio.
Thanks, ladies and gentlemen. It's KCNR, Shasta Redding.